Marissa Kennedy was a bright, curious 10-year-old who loved school projects, Friday pizza, and her golden retriever, Daisy. She carried her sketchbook everywhere, doodling flowers and daydreaming about summer adventures. But behind her warm smile and expressive eyes, a silent horror was unfolding. For months, nobody outside the Carrillo home pieced the bruises silently forming under Marissa's sleeve, or the fear in her voice when she spoke about bedtime. The adults who saw the signs reported them, teachers, nurses, neighbors, but their warnings slipped into a system that did not act. On February 25th, 2018, the unthinkable happened. A young life ended not in an accident, but by relentless cruelty from the people sworn to protect her. As the details emerged, they revealed not just a crime, but a failure of trust that shatters belief in safety for every child. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Hidden Cracks. Marissa's laughter echoed through the hallway at Stockton Springs Elementary School as she skipped into the classroom. She wore her favorite purple hoodie, the one with a unicorn prancing across the front. Her teacher, Ms. Thompson, greeted her every morning with a gentle nod. Marissa was every teacher's dream, attentive, inquisitive, polite. She loved reading chapter books and often stayed after class to ask questions about science. But over the winter of 2016 to 2017, her sparkle dimmed slightly. She started coming in with dark circles under her eyes, and one day, she had a thin, pale bruise by her elbow. Ms. Thompson remembered that moment like a sudden storm cloud. She asked Marissa if she was okay, but the child looked away and said she tripped on a playground rock. The explanation felt odd, but not alarming enough to raise alarms. So Ms. Thompson noted it in her mind and carried on. Weeks later, Marissa arrived at school limping. The school nurse, Mrs. Ellis, checked her carefully. Marissa said she fell while walking the dog, but Mrs. Ellis noticed the bruise was old, yellowing at the edges. Concerned, she filed a report with Child Protective Services, but that first voice was lost in the echoes of bureaucracy, and no one called her back. Marissa's fun energy gradually gave way to tired stillness. She no longer asked to stay after class. Classroom chatter quieted as she approached. Her thoughtful smile lingered, but she no longer shared details about weekend outings or Daisy's antics. Still, she did her work, quietly, diligently. In December at the Christmas concert, Marissa stood in line with her classmates under the bright stage lights. She wore a green sparkly dress. As the music began, she smiled for her mother, camera poised, but another parent noticed the bruise again, this time on her cheek. The parent spoke to a school counselor, who filed another report, hoping someone would look deeper this time. In the cold months, reports piled up. Bruises, signs of neglect, a child's exhaustion. 6 separate times by 3 school staff members, counselors and nurses raised concerns between late 2016 and early 2018. But each report bounced between the Maine Department of Health and Human Services, and no investigation was opened. Caseworkers cited lack of immediate danger. Behind the scenes, the Carrillo household itself seemed calm in outward appearance. Sharon Kennedy, formerly Carrillo, and her husband Julio held down jobs. Neighbors remembered greeting Marissa at the bus stop. Her mother wore warm sweaters and made polite conversation, but behind the door, evidence accumulated too awful to imagine. One chilly afternoon, Ms. Thompson found a lunchbox note folded in half. It read, in shaky, childlike writing, "I am scared." The teacher's heart sank. She held the note for a moment, imagining the fear that carved those words onto a page. This was the 3rd or 4th time she had felt that sinking feeling. Each bruise, each quiet tear, each silent stall into shadows. She took the note immediately to the principal, Mr. Adams. He spoke to the school's child safety liaison. They had done everything they were allowed to do, file reports, make calls, but every caseworker they reached refused to intervene without new, undeniable proof. The threshold was said to be high. "If you get a video, bring it," they were told. The room felt thick with frustration. They spoke in soft voices about procedure. They spoke about risk. They spoke about files they had closed earlier. They spoke about budget shortfalls, staff shortages, cold policy manuals. By February 2018, 25 reports had been filed by educators, medical staff, and neighbors. One concerned neighbor had even heard a frightening sound, like a child moaning in pain, from the Carrillo home in the early morning. She teary-eyed, called the DHHS tip line. Still, the system hesitated. At the same time, Marissa told a friend at school she felt sick, but not with a cold. She said her stomach hurt all the time. The school nurse again documented it. She suggested a doctor visit. Parents said they would take her. No one followed up. Behind the Bear Lodge sign that marked the school entrance, the last bus loaded up. Marissa climbed aboard without complaint. No one realized it would carry the weight of a child too broken to speak. That afternoon, Ms. Thompson couldn't stop thinking about the bruise. She drew a sketch of a simple purple unicorn on a post-it note, then scribbled, "Please be okay," beneath it. She planned to tape it inside Marissa's locker, hoping to offer small solace. Instead, she left it in her desk, unsure what help it could be. At home that night, Marissa sat by the window, her purple hoodie pulled tight. She whispered to Daisy as she carried her sketchbook upstairs. The bruise itched, her stomach ached, but she was determined, as always, to draw something new. She opened her sketchbook and gently traced the outline of a flower she'd seen in a book. The petals trembled under her pencil, as if afraid to bloom. Marissa's story at Stockton Springs was one of growing cracks in a system too rigid to heal them. She wore kindness like armor in school, but the pain followed her into every safe space. And as she walked those hallways, no one realized the darkness gathering just beyond the door of her own home. Chapter 2, The Reports. In a corner office at the Department of Health and Human Services in Augusta, Maine, the inbox was already full by 8:12 a.m. on a Wednesday morning in January 2018. Among the unread emails was a flagged message from Stockton Springs Elementary School. It detailed concerns from two different faculty members about a student named Marissa Kennedy. The subject line read, "Urgent, possible ongoing abuse. Follow-up required." It would be the 18th report filed on her behalf. It would also go unanswered. To understand how this could happen, we must understand the system built to protect children like Marissa. Maine's child welfare system, at the time, was stretched thin. Budget cuts, overwhelming caseloads, and poor interagency communication created a fragile safety net. Child protection caseworkers were expected to juggle up to 20 or even 30 cases at once, each one a potential tragedy. Some quit under pressure. Others stayed and grew numb. The first report on Marissa Kennedy came in October 2016, when a school nurse noticed a bruise that didn't match the story Marissa gave. That nurse followed protocol. She filed a written report, called the state hotline, and documented everything. DHHS acknowledged receipt, but no investigation was launched. The reason? The bruising was deemed nonspecific, and the child's environment appeared supervised. That language, nonspecific, supervised, became a shield that let Marissa's suffering continue unchecked. By March 2017, three more reports had come in, one from a counselor who described Marissa's unusual fear response when her mother entered the room, one from a pediatrician who saw repeated bruising around her ribs, and one from a neighbor who noticed Marissa limping outside. In each case, the DHHS screened the report, but instead of assigning a caseworker to investigate, they marked the cases as information only. Even when a school official called to follow up and ask why nothing was happening, she was told that unless there was evidence of serious bodily injury or direct disclosure from the child, there was little that could be done. Marissa was too afraid to tell the truth, and the bruises were never quite enough. By November 2017, a breaking point had come. Mrs. Ellis, the school nurse, took matters into her own hands. She typed a 4-page summary of every injury she had documented over the last year. Dates, locations, colors, comments from Marissa. She attached photos taken with school permission and sent them directly to a supervisor she knew at DHHS. Still, the response was tepid. "Thank you for your concern," the email read. "We are reviewing the information for patterns of harm and will determine if this meets criteria for investigation." No one came to the school. No one called the nurse. Inside the Carrillo home, things were getting worse. Julio Carrillo had become more violent, according to later confessions. He reportedly used belts, fists, and even a mop handle. He made Marissa kneel for hours at a time in the living room with her hands raised. Sometimes he recorded it. Sharon Carrillo, her mother, told police later that she participated because she was afraid. But police and prosecutors would point out, she beat Marissa too. And yet, the system outside the home continued to sleep. In early February 2018, a final round of reports arrived. A substitute teacher reported seeing Marissa flinch hard when her name was called. Another teacher saw her fall asleep in class twice in 1 week. A janitor mentioned overhearing her crying in the bathroom. But no one knew what was happening behind closed doors. That Julio had forced Marissa to walk on injured legs, to hold her arms above her head for hours. That she had collapsed more than once. That Sharon had locked her in a room with no food. That her body was giving out. The calls kept coming and the files kept stacking. The system simply could not move fast enough. At one point, a DHHS intake worker scribbled a handwritten note in Marissa's file. It read, "Multiple red flags. Follow-up strongly advised. Monitor school attendance and medical visits." No follow-up occurred. No one visited. The final report before her death came just 5 days before Marissa collapsed and never got up again. She had gone to school just once in February. She told the school nurse she didn't want to go home, that she wanted to sleep somewhere else. It was the closest she ever came to a direct plea for help. By then, her body was breaking down from internal injuries, a lacerated liver, bleeding in her brain, deep muscle bruises. Her spine was inflamed from constant impact. But no one outside the Carrillo home saw her again. The system had the information. 25 reports in total, 6 from the school, 15 from medical professionals, 4 from neighbors. Each one a flare fired into the dark sky, ignored, dismissed, or delayed. And behind all those missed chances stood one child, drawing flowers in a sketchbook, kneeling for hours, sleeping in pain, waiting. When the truth finally came out, Maine's child protective infrastructure was already under national scrutiny. But for Marissa Kennedy, the response came far too late. Chapter 3. Inside the Carrillo Home. On the outside, the Carrillo Home looked ordinary. It was a white, 2-story building on a quiet road in Stockton Springs, Maine, near the water's edge. The snow-covered front steps led to a modest porch with a red front door and a few plastic flower pots. Neighbors who passed by saw little activity. A man came and went at odd hours. A woman sometimes stood by the mailbox in the cold. A child was rarely seen. But behind the red door, Marissa Kennedy lived through a daily nightmare that no one could hear. The home was quiet most of the time, eerily so. Sharon Carrillo, Marissa's mother, spent most of her time in the living room, either folding clothes or scrolling on her phone. Julio Carrillo, the stepfather, was in control. He worked construction during the day, and when he returned, the tone in the house shifted. He didn't raise his voice often. He didn't need to. His rules were carved into fear. According to court records and confessions, Julio's abuse followed a pattern. He made Marissa kneel on the tile floor, with her hands held high for hours at a time. If she dropped her arms or moved, he hit her. He used belts, mop handles, and his fists. He made her repeat apologies out loud, over and over, until she was sobbing from pain and exhaustion. Sometimes, Sharon watched silently. Other times, she participated. One piece of video evidence obtained by investigators would later shake the courtroom. Marissa, shaking, is seen on the floor, her arms raised, mumbling that she was sorry. Julio stood in the corner with a phone, recording. Sharon sat on the couch, giving orders in a low voice. In another video, Marissa is seen with bruises on her face, crying silently, as Julio instructs her to say what you did. Her voice is so soft it barely registers. There is no yelling, no chaos, just quiet, methodical terror. Sharon Carrillo later claimed she was also abused by Julio, that she feared him, and that her actions were controlled by him. Her defense attorney would argue that she was a victim too, but prosecutors pointed to text messages and video recordings, showing Sharon actively participating, even instructing Marissa during the punishments. They said it wasn't fear, it was complicity. One of the darkest revelations came during Sharon's confession. She admitted that in the days leading up to Marissa's death, the girl had collapsed multiple times. She couldn't walk. She struggled to speak. Her mother and stepfather believed she was faking to avoid punishment, so they beat her harder. One night, Marissa collapsed in the bathroom. She vomited and soiled herself. Julio dragged her by her arms back to the living room and forced her to kneel. Sharon said nothing. Later, she brought her a washcloth but told her to stay awake. Julio slapped her when she closed her eyes. By the final night, Marissa could no longer stand. She was unresponsive, lying on the floor in a fetal position, unable to move. Julio told Sharon she needed to clean up the mess before he got home. When Sharon checked on Marissa an hour later, she wasn't breathing. Panic set in. They didn't call 911 immediately. They waited. They discussed what to say. Finally, they made the call, claiming Marissa had fallen and hit her head. When police and EMTs arrived, Marissa's body was already cold. The medical examiner who performed her autopsy found more than 50 distinct injuries on her body. There were bruises in various stages of healing, indicating long-term abuse. There was a partially healed fracture in her rib cage. Her liver was lacerated. She had bleeding in her brain. The official cause of death was ruled battered child syndrome. Photos from the investigation showed a mattress on the floor, stained with blood and vomit. Marissa's room had no toys, no books, no signs of joy, just silence. During questioning, Julio Carrillo quickly admitted the abuse. He said Marissa was a handful and manipulative. He said she would make up things and pretend to be sick. His calm demeanor during confession was chilling. There was no remorse, only justification. Sharon's confession came days later, after pressure from detectives. She appeared emotionally unstable, crying at times, confused at others. But in her signed statement, she described the punishments in detail, the kneeling, the slaps, the silence. She claimed Julio forced her to hurt her daughter, but when asked why she didn't stop it, why she didn't run, call the police, or protect Marissa, she had no answer. The truth was unbearable. The people Marissa trusted most, her mother and stepfather, became her jailers, and her jail was not made of steel bars. It was built from silence, bruises, and nights with no mercy. The community was in shock. Neighbors who once waved at the quiet family now stood behind yellow crime scene tape, weeping. Teachers sat in staff meetings staring at their notes, wondering what more they could have done. Nurses cried in their cars, replaying the missed signs. Everyone wanted to know, how could this happen? But for Marissa, that question had no comfort. Her final days were spent in a prison of pain and neglect, and even though the walls were thin and the reports were loud, no one came soon enough. Chapter 4, The Final Days. The house was colder in February, not just from the main winter air seeping through the old windows, but from something deeper, an emotional frost that had settled over the Carrillo home. Marissa Kennedy, once full of quiet resilience, had grown still. Her body, worn from months of relentless abuse, was shutting down, and no one in that house lifted a hand to save her. In the mornings, Marissa barely moved from the thin mattress on the floor. Her face was pale, her arms trembling. She no longer protested. She no longer begged, she just obeyed. When her stepfather barked orders to kneel or hold her hands high, she tried. And when her body gave out, he hit her. Sometimes it was with a belt, sometimes with his hands, sometimes with whatever was nearby. Sharon Carrillo told detectives that she watched her daughter collapse in the bathroom a few days before her death. Marissa was crying. She had trouble standing. She had soiled herself. Instead of helping, Sharon called Julio, who dragged the child by her wrists back into the living room. She was ordered to kneel again. When her arms drooped, Julio struck her. He believed she was faking, but there was nothing fake about what was happening. Marissa had internal bleeding. Her liver was lacerated. There was hemorrhaging in her brain. Her spine was bruised. Her legs were inflamed. She had wounds in various stages of healing, including older rib fractures and muscle damage. Her tiny body was shutting down from trauma inflicted over weeks and months, not just days. In the final 72 hours of her life, Marissa stopped talking. She barely moved. She lay on the floor in a fetal position, occasionally moaning, her breath ragged. Sharon claimed she tried to feed her, but Marissa couldn't swallow. When asked later by police why she didn't seek medical help, Sharon said she thought her daughter was just tired. The truth was unbearable. They knew she was dying. On the night of February 24th, Sharon and Julio talked quietly in the kitchen while Marissa lay on the living room floor, wrapped in a thin blanket. At one point, Sharon checked on her. She was cold, her skin was turning pale, her lips were blue. Still, no one called for help. It wasn't until the next morning, February 25th, 2018, that they finally dialed 911. The call was calm. Sharon told the dispatcher that Marissa had fallen and was unresponsive. She claimed it was an accident. She sounded distant, disconnected, cold. First responders arrived to find Marissa already dead. Her body was stiff. Her face was bruised. There were injuries to her head, chest, and back. Blood and vomit had soaked into the floor where she lay. Her eyes were half closed. Her body weighed only 58 pounds. Paramedics knew instantly that this wasn't a fall. Police were called to the scene, and both Sharon and Julio were separated for questioning. Their stories quickly began to fall apart. Sharon couldn't explain why Marissa had so many bruises in so many places. Julio claimed she had been clumsy and difficult. Then, detectives found the videos. The Carrillos hadn't deleted them. One clip showed Marissa kneeling, shaking, while Julio stood nearby, recording her punishment. Another showed Sharon ordering her to confess to something while she whimpered on the floor. These weren't the actions of panicked parents. These were calculated acts of cruelty. An autopsy later confirmed what police already suspected. Marissa had not died from a single injury. She died from a long pattern of systemic abuse. She suffered blunt force trauma to the head, chest, and abdomen. There were more than 50 injuries. Her cause of death was officially listed as battered child syndrome. The community went into shock. Outside Stockton Springs Elementary School, where Marissa had once been a smiling fourth grader, parents gathered for a candlelight vigil. Her teachers spoke through tears. One left a note pinned to the school's front door. "We saw you. We tried. We're so sorry we didn't save you." The press picked up the story within hours. Photos of Marissa, a smiling girl with long brown hair and a shy grin, flashed across national news. Everyone wanted to know, how did this happen? How did 25 reports fail to protect one child? The investigation widened. Lawmakers demanded answers from the Department of Health and Human Services. News stations ran timelines of every warning that had been ignored. Reporters uncovered more tragic details, and the public, rightfully horrified, called for systemic change. But none of that would bring Marissa back. Her last days were spent in silence, under the control of two adults who stripped away her childhood piece by piece. Her cries went unheard. Her drawings went unfinished. Her body gave up before the system did. There would be arrests. There would be trials. There would be change. But first, there was a funeral. Marissa Kennedy was buried in a small white casket with purple flowers placed on top, the same color as the hoodie she once wore to school. Her golden retriever, Daisy, now in the care of a neighbor, sat quietly at the back of the ceremony. No one could forget her, not anymore. Chapter 5. Trial and Verdict. The courtroom was silent as Sharon Carrillo entered in handcuffs, flanked by armed deputies. Her face was pale, her hair pulled back. She wore a plain beige jumpsuit. Eyes from the press and public followed her every step. Cameras were not allowed inside, but the weight of the moment was unmistakable. On the other side of the room sat Julio Carrillo, already separated legally, already deep into a confession that stunned even seasoned officers. The two were no longer a couple. They were co-defendants in the murder of 10-year-old Marissa Kennedy. The trial of Sharon Carrillo began in late 2019. By that point, Julio had pleaded guilty to depraved indifference murder. He admitted to the months of abuse, to forcing Marissa to kneel, to striking her with objects, and to ignoring her medical distress. His sentencing had been swift, 55 years in prison, no chance of parole for decades. But Sharon's case was different, complicated by claims of domestic abuse, psychological manipulation, and her own capacity for violence. Her defense attorneys built their strategy around one central claim, that Sharon was a victim too. They said she had been beaten, coerced, and psychologically broken down by Julio, that he orchestrated the abuse, that she was afraid to defy him. They presented photos of bruises on Sharon's body and played audio clips from jailhouse calls that suggested fear and control. Her attorney described her as a battered woman who is also a grieving mother. But the prosecution wasn't moved. They played the videos recovered from Sharon's phone, the same videos that showed Marissa sobbing, kneeling, shaking, while her mother watched. Sometimes Sharon gave instructions. Other times, she said nothing as Julio struck the child off camera. There was one video in particular where Sharon told Marissa to admit what you did, as the girl sat motionless on the floor, too weak to speak. The prosecutor, Lean Zionea, did not pull punches. In opening statements, she said, "This child died from months of horrific abuse, and Sharon Carrillo didn't just witness it. She joined in, she helped hide it, and she let it happen every single day until Marissa took her last breath." The prosecution presented a timeline, painfully detailed, of every documented injury, every missed chance, every ignored report. They called former teachers to the stand, medical staff, caseworkers. Each one described their growing concern, their frustration with the system, and their heartbreak when they learned the truth. The jury listened to Sharon's confession in full, nearly 2 hours of interview with detectives. Her voice cracked. She wept. She admitted to beating her daughter with her hands and with objects. She described how Julio would force Marissa to hold her hands up for hours. She admitted that, in her own words, "I should have done something." When the defense cross-examined, they tried to show that Sharon had a low IQ, a history of being abused by Julio, and diminished decision-making power. They brought in a psychological expert who said Sharon was vulnerable, suggestible, and lacked the ability to resist her husband's control. But the prosecution pointed to inconsistencies in her story. How Sharon had initially tried to blame Marissa's injuries on a fall, how she deleted some messages from her phone, and how she continued to lie until confronted with video evidence. In closing arguments, the prosecutor asked the jury one simple question. If your child was dying, if she couldn't walk, couldn't eat, couldn't speak, would you watch her suffer, or would you do something? Sharon Carrillo did nothing. It took the jury just 2 days to return with a verdict. Guilty. Murder. On sentencing day, the judge addressed the court with visible emotion. He acknowledged Sharon's claims of domestic abuse, but made clear that her actions, or lack thereof, contributed directly to her daughter's death. "You had a duty, as a mother, as a human being, and you failed in the most heartbreaking way imaginable." Sharon Carrillo was sentenced to 48 years in prison. The public reaction was swift. Some sympathized with the abuse narrative. Others were outraged that she wasn't sentenced to life. But most were united in one thing. Marissa Kennedy's name became a symbol, a reminder, a warning, a call to fix what was broken. Outside the courthouse, reporters crowded the steps. Teachers from Marissa's school stood together silently, holding hands. One carried a small photo of Marissa in a glittery Christmas dress. Another clutched a folded letter the child had once written. It read simply, "I wish I could be happy all the time." That letter, found in a desk at school, was never sent home. Now, it was held like a piece of her memory, fragile, powerful, unfinished. The trials had ended, but the questions were only beginning. Chapter 6, Aftermath and Reform. The courtroom had gone quiet, but the public uproar had only just begun. In the weeks following Sharon Carrillo's conviction, parents, educators, activists, and lawmakers across Maine demanded answers. The question echoed from newsrooms to government buildings to living rooms across the state. How could this happen? Marissa Kennedy's death was more than a family tragedy. It was a systemic failure, a collapse of every layer of protection meant to safeguard a child. 25 reports had been filed. School staff had begged for intervention. Medical professionals had flagged injuries. Neighbors had heard the screams.
And still, nothing had been done.
Governor Janet Mills, newly elected at the time, called for an immediate review of the Department of Health and Human Services. The Office of Child and Family Services, OCFS, came under intense scrutiny. It wasn't the first time Maine's child welfare system had been criticized, but it was the first time the outrage was this loud, this widespread, and this personal. In an emergency press conference, the DHHS commissioner admitted what many already feared, that internal communication had failed, that many frontline caseworkers were overloaded, and that reporting tools were outdated. In a somber statement, she said, "We failed Marissa, and we must never let that happen again." Reform efforts moved quickly. Within 6 months, the state rolled out a sweeping series of changes. First, staffing was overhauled. The state increased the number of child protective caseworkers and improved their salaries to help reduce burnout and turnover. Caseloads were capped to ensure each case received proper attention. Training programs were revamped to focus on trauma-informed care and early pattern recognition. Second, technology systems were upgraded. The old system used to track reports was paper-heavy and slow. A new centralized digital system was launched, allowing teachers, doctors, and law enforcement to flag cases in real time. It connected all agencies instantly. No more faxes, no more waiting days for callbacks. Third, cross-agency collaboration was strengthened. A new state law required DHHS to work more directly with schools and hospitals, creating regional task forces made up of educators, pediatricians, social workers, and child safety officers. These teams met monthly to review high-risk cases and follow up. Fourth, accountability measures were introduced. An independent oversight board was established to audit cases of child deaths or near deaths. For the first time in Maine's history, there was a transparent channel for the public to review how the system responded or failed to respond. The changes were fast and, for many, not enough. Critics pointed out that it took a child's death to make officials act. Some felt the reforms were cosmetic, not cultural. But even skeptics had to acknowledge that the name Marissa Kennedy had become a turning point. Educators across Maine changed how they documented abuse suspicions. Where once they'd hesitated or assumed someone else had reported, now they followed up. Teachers were empowered to escalate concerns directly to law enforcement if DHHS didn't respond. Pediatricians added new checklists to their exams. School counselors attended more workshops. The warning signs that had been missed were now highlighted in bold.
Public school districts also introduced the Marissa Protocol, a multi-step escalation process for repeated student injuries or absenteeism. If a child missed more than 3 consecutive days with no medical note and prior concern had been filed, a mandatory in-person welfare check was now required.
But the emotional toll remained.
Stockton Springs Elementary never quite recovered. Ms. Thompson, Marissa's former teacher, took a leave of absence. She later returned, but admitted she still couldn't walk past Marissa's old seat without tears welling up. The school placed a plaque in the library. In memory of Marissa Kennedy, a life that mattered.
A scholarship fund was created in her name for students pursuing careers in child advocacy or social work. Her sketchbook, found by police during the investigation, was returned to the school. Inside were flowers, stars, and one simple drawing of a girl standing beneath the words, "One day, I'll be strong." That image was scanned and printed on posters that now hang in every school across the district. A symbol, a reminder. Legislators, in turn, passed the Child Welfare Accountability Act, mandating that all cases involving multiple reports be reviewed by a second supervisor before being closed. It also required annual public reporting of child abuse fatalities and near misses in the state. Marissa's story was even discussed nationally. News anchors compared her case to those in other states, like Gabriel Fernandez in California and Zymir Perkins in New York, pointing out how vulnerable children continued to fall through the cracks of overwhelmed systems.
But in Maine, it was personal. Marissa was theirs.
In church basements, people lit candles. In playgrounds, parents watched their children more closely. In homes across the state, conversations turned serious. What would I do? Would I report it?
Would I follow up?
And for those in the system, the teachers, the nurses, the social workers, Marissa's name was no longer just part of a file. She became a reason to speak louder, act faster, and never assume someone else will take care of it. Chapter 7, Legacy and Climax. Years have passed since the cold morning when emergency responders found Marissa Kennedy lifeless on the floor of her home. Yet her presence lingers in classrooms, in courtrooms, and in the hearts of those who tried to save her. Her name has become more than a headline. It is a lesson, a vow, a legacy. At Stockton Springs Elementary, the teachers still speak her name softly. On the wall beside the library hangs a framed copy of one of Marissa's last drawings, a little girl standing beneath a tall sunflower, her hand outstretched toward the sky. Beneath it, a small brass plaque reads,
"In honor of Marissa Kennedy, let no child suffer unseen."
Ms. Thompson, her fourth grade teacher, returned to teaching a year after the trial ended. She now leads a training seminar for new educators on recognizing the warning signs of abuse. Those subtle shifts in behavior, the quiet flinches, the hidden bruises. She tells them not just what to do, but how much it matters. "You may be the only voice that child has," she says, her voice steady. "Don't assume someone else will make the call." In Augusta, the new Office of Child Protection Review publishes annual reports on intervention failures and success stories. Each case is reviewed with brutal honesty. Marissa's file, redacted but studied, remains one of the cornerstone documents. It is shown to every new hire in the department.
Julio Carrillo sits in a maximum security prison in Maine. He has never spoken publicly since his conviction. According to prison staff, he keeps to himself. He has not expressed remorse.
Sharon Carrillo, incarcerated at a separate women's facility, filed multiple appeals. Her attorneys continue to argue that she was a victim of domestic violence and manipulation. But to the courts and to the public, the facts remain clear. She did nothing to stop the suffering of her daughter, and that silence made her guilty.
Marissa's extended family, once fractured, has come together around her memory. Her aunt, who lives in Portland, speaks at child welfare events and school safety conferences. She carries a laminated photo of Marissa in her coat pocket, smiling in that green Christmas dress, just a few months before her death. When she talks, her voice always breaks at the same point. She loved to draw. She loved sunflowers. She deserved more time. But perhaps the most powerful legacy lies in the children who were saved because of her.
In Bangor, a teacher noticed a student who stopped talking in class. Her smile faded. The bruises were faint, almost nothing. But the teacher filed a report. Then she followed up. She pushed. That child was rescued within days. In Lewiston, a nurse flagged a second visit from a boy with a fractured wrist. It led to a full investigation and protection for three children living in neglect. These are the lives that Marissa continues to touch. Quiet victories, silent rescues, invisible lives changed because someone remembered. Her story remains a turning point for the state of Maine. Her name, once spoken in grief, is now invoked in determination. Advocacy groups host annual awareness campaigns in her honor. Legislators propose new bills under Marissa's Law, focused on mandatory follow-ups and stronger reporting enforcement. And across school districts, the Marissa Protocol remains in effect, one of the few silver linings to emerge from the darkness. It ensures that no report goes unanswered, that no child is ignored, that no flinch, no tear, no absence is ever brushed aside again. But despite the reforms, despite the tributes, one truth remains unchanged. A 10-year-old girl died in silence. Not because no one cared, but because the system built to protect her failed to listen in time. That truth burns. It reminds us that protection is not passive. It demands vigilance. It demands courage. It demands action. Marissa's final drawing, a girl reaching for a sunflower, is now etched into memory. Not because of how she died, but because of how she should have lived. And because of her, thousands of eyes are now wide open. So when the next teacher hesitates, the next nurse worries, the next neighbor hears something wrong, they remember her, and they do not wait.